You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everyone. If I can ask you to take a seat, please. I'm Norman Eisen, and I want to welcome you all to the Brookings Institution's Governance Studies program for this afternoon's panel with some of the most distinguished opinion leaders in Washington, D.C. and globally on the subject of promoting good governance and fighting corruption. And we're going to study that subject in the specific example of natural resource management. And I'm Norman Eisen. I'll be moderating today's panel. And with me today are Deputy Secretary Michael Connor of the United States Department of the Interior, Danielle Bryan, the Executive Director of the Project on Government Oversight, Tony Cudmore, the Chief Public Affairs Officer of BHP Billiton, Nathaniel Heller, the Managing Director of RDI, the Results for Development Institute, and Robert Hunja, the Director of Public Integrity and Openness at the World Bank. And I'd like to begin by inviting the Deputy Secretary to lead off today's panel. Deputy Secretary Connor has been confirmed as the Deputy Secretary of the United States Department of the Interior in February 2014. He's been serving ever since as the second highest ranking official at the department with statutory responsibilities as the Chief Operating Officer of this agency of more than 70,000 employees. He knows them all personally. With an annual budget of approximately $12 billion. He's been a key leader in implementing the administration's priorities for the Department of the Interior, including water policy, dealing with the unprecedented Western drought, as well as serving as the head of the department's land buyback program, the land consolidation component of the Cabell settlement, and comes to these responsibilities after more than two decades of experience in the public sector. Mr. Deputy Secretary.
Thank you very much, Norman. I would just note, I'm going to show him an optimism. I'm not going to express the fact that, you know, we've been having to prepare for shutdown possibilities at the end of this week. I do not think that will happen. I think we're well on our way to avoid that. But I will also, my optimist part is our budget request is $13 billion, so I hope to oversee a $13 billion agency as opposed to a $12 billion agency. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you to talk about good governance and certainly fighting corruption and the U.S. Efforts to lead in that area. I want to take a brief moment to highlight how the Department of the Interior is partnering with corporations and NGOs to increase the transparency of natural resources management overall, but then certainly highlight the progress that we are making in implementing the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, EITI. Overall, I'd say transparency, accountability, and the public trust are key pillars in carrying out the vast mission of the Department of the Interior. For context, we manage 20% of the nation's land base, which is over 500 million acres. We oversee development of about 21% of the United States energy supplies. We contribute about $360 billion annually to the U.S. economy through energy, recreation, water resource management, and scientific activities. And we protect the natural resources, our country's heritage, as well as honor and serve Native American communities. So it's quite a broad and vast mission we have at the department. The energy and natural resources for which Interior is responsible cross domestic and international jurisdictional boundaries, so we do have an international presence. And just as an example of our, just a quick list of items that we're doing in the international arena. We confront illegal wildlife trading. We work with other countries to stop the spread of invasive species. We collaborate on transboundary resource issues. We provide scientific expertise to address global issues of huge importance, such as climate change. And, of course, which I think gets to the issue we're talking about today, We have significant economic activity in this country based on extractive industries and natural resources richness in this country. Interior plays a significant role, obviously, in the president's all-of-the-above energy strategy. We want to secure a responsible, cleaner, and sustainable energy future for the country. And one of the core objectives of our energy reform agenda is to increase transparency and restore public trust in how we manage, particularly at the Interior Department, approximately $10 billion in revenues annually from energy development on federal lands and waters. In 2010, in the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon tragedy offshore in the Gulf of Mexico, Interior reform management of conventional and renewable energy development, both onshore and offshore, by separating the leasing, safety, and revenue management functions of the former Minerals Management Service. And that was, in our view, a much better model for governing and regulating industries from that standpoint. This resulted in the creation of the Office of Natural Resources Revenue, HONOR as we call it, and set the stage for demonstrating our commitment to transparency and accountability by leading domestic implementation of EITI. Now, this administration has numerous open government initiatives, and obviously the president places a high priority on making government more effective, transparent, and responsive to the needs of its citizens. And yesterday, once again, the president was at the UN Conference on Sustainable Development Goals, and he reiterated this same theme about the need, the implications of bad governments, corrupt governments, and how they impact their citizens. In prioritizing a more open government, President Obama has challenged each federal agency to take affirmative steps to raise the bar on openness and stakeholder participation, as well as harness technology to make government data more accessible and useful for everyday citizens. So there's three fundamental principles I think EITI furthers and that the department is strongly committed to recognizing and understanding and implementing. There's a powerful link between transparency, accountability, and the public trust. They go together. Freely available data is a valuable national resource and strategic asset to government, its partners, and the public overall. And open data strengthens our democracy, promotes efficiency and effectiveness in government, and it has immense potential to create economic opportunity and improve the quality of life for our citizens. Through the open government partnership and our initiatives, we lead by example, both domestically and internationally, by challenging all countries to make commitment to promote transparency, to fight corruption, and to empower citizen engagement. So at the heart of the U.S. EITI initiative that we at the Interior Department are leading is the multi-stakeholder group, which provides the platform for collaborative consensus-based model of decision-making that's necessary for the successful implementation of EITI. The MSG meetings are open to the public and provide a forum where the public, industry, and government stakeholders can come together and openly consult and inform public policy dialogue. It is a marathon. It's not a sprint to fully implement EITI, but the progress has been methodical and constant. That's the good news. In March 2014, the U.S. successfully completed the initial application requirements and achieved EITI candidate country status. In December 2014, to achieve one of the commitments made in the candidacy application, Interior launched a new data portal to disclose energy and natural resource revenue data and to ensure that the data is easy to understand for the public. So we were looking at this earlier today. I think US EITI.doi.gov is the website. It's not just a bunch of data thrown out there. It's really got a narrative associated with it, and it's intended to explain as well as provide information. So this data portal, coupled with the upcoming first annual report from US EITI, I think raises the bar on the transparency of natural resource data. Also, as the president constantly reminds all of us, we need to walk the walk, not just talk the talk. And so U.S. EITI implementation also ensures that the U.S. is leading by example. We're not alone, obviously. Other Western democracies like the U.K. and Germany have led in this area. This past spring, though, it gives us an opportunity to advocate. And this past spring, when I was in Mexico, I met with my counterpart at CENER, the Mexican Energy Secretariat, Deputy Secretary Lourdes Melgar. It was very encouraging, her strong personal commitment to EITI, as well as the subsequent announcements by Mexico to move forward with the initiative. So, bottom line is there's much work to be done, but we have made progress. I want to conclude by applauding the efforts of each sector in the multi-stakeholder group, in particular, shout out to our co-chairs, Danielle Bryan, of the Project Government Oversight, representing as a co-chair of the civil society sector, and Veronica Kohler of the National Mining Association, who is our co-chair from the industry sector. My interior team, our leads, Paul Mussenden, Paul is sitting here today, and Greg Gould, they've explained to me that the conversations within the MSG are robust, active, sometimes intense, even as of late, but they all laud the progress that have been made by the group and the openness to the dialogue, and that we are moving forward in continuing to improve transparency. So with that, I will turn it over.
Thank you, Mr. Deputy Secretary. And having heard from government, we'll now hear from a representative of U.S. civil society and from a global business, both of which are deeply engaged in this. A few, before I introduce them, just a couple of logistics announcements. I have to add my appreciation to Paul for his outstanding work in putting together this program. Thank you, Paul. I want to remind everybody who's standing at the back, there are a few seats up front if you'd like to come and join us. Thank you. There are lemon bars remaining at the back. I vouch for them. We're all friends here, so no one will take it amiss if you get up and have a lemon bar and a cup of coffee as we go through. And also, we would like to thank BHP Billiton for their generous support of our governance studies program. So my friend Danielle Bryan has been the executive director of the Project on Government Oversight since 1993. She frequently testifies before Congress and regularly meets with members of Congress and officials at the White House and federal agencies to discuss how to achieve a more effective, accountable, open, and ethical federal government. When I was responsible for these issues at the White House on the campaign and the transition and at the White House in 2008 and 9 and 10, I frequently met with Danielle, and I can vouch for how what an effective advocate she is, and it's no wonder that the U.S. EITI, multi-stakeholder group, has chosen her as the co-chair and as the chair of the civil society component. So, Danielle, over to you.
Thank you very much for those very kind words. And your team at Interior has been really extraordinary also. I wanted to say that it's been a challenge, as they've described, but also a very rewarding process for us to be working on this together. So the question I think many in the U.S. Asked when the prospect of applying EITI in the United States was, why does disclosure of revenues derived from natural resources matter in the U.S., and how does that help combat corruption here? So the U.S. might not have the same kind of corruption that is endemic in other parts of the world, but that doesn't mean we don't have big problems here. And we still have a vast amount of what some of us would call legalized corruption because of the undue influence of industry over public policy. So it was not, for example, in the not-too-distant recent history that MMS, the Minerals Management Service, was in the headlines because of, in general, an inappropriate relationship between government and industry. Much of that has been fueled, for example, because of the very legal revolving door. But that has raised public concerns about the relationship between industry and government. The second big reason why EITI was important for the public in the U.S. is that many public policies, including, for example, the General Mining Act of 1872, which is still on the books, royalty relief and other tax subsidies are encouraging production while depressing or negating payment for them. The public needs more information on who is really benefiting from those industry-friendly policies. And the third big reason, at least from my perspective, why having this kind of transparency initiative in the U.S. is important is that tax avoidance, legal but real, is an increasingly domestic concern. There's been global activities working in that sector for a while, but I think in the U.S. it's becoming more apparent. The U.S. tax laws are making it impossible to know how much, if any, taxes are being paid or not paid for extracting natural resources. So I would say that USCITI is already helping with the first two. This has been my first experience in multi-sector decision-making. As Norm mentioned, I have a fair amount of experience working with the government, but I have to say this is the first time I've ever sat down with industry. And I think that we have a lot to be proud of as we're wrapping up the first report, which is going to be released in December. And some of the insights that I want to highlight that you're going to see when the report is finalized were based on decisions that have been made because of this multi-sector decision-making process over the last couple of years. One of the highlights, I think, is that in the U.S., we've expanded the kinds of commodities that are going to be incorporated in terms of revenues that are generated from the extraction of these commodities beyond oil, gas, and coal to include hard rock minerals, renewables, and we're going to be working in the next year towards figuring out how to expand into forestry. Another important value added, I think, that's happening in the U.S. is that we're the first, if not one of the first countries, to be looking at the fiscal impacts, not just of the revenues, but also the costs of extractive activity. And so what that means is we're in the process of gathering, and one of the things we're finding is sometimes the data just isn't available, and that is in itself an important thing for us to discover. But where we can find it, 10 years of data on direct employment, as well as in 12 counties that were selected through a lot of negotiations, costs to the public for emergency services, water, road infrastructure, and reclamation due to extractive activity. And the other thing that you should have taken credit for, but I'll give it to you for you, is that the Department of Interior has unilaterally already disclosed 100% of the royalty revenues by company. So this is something that was happening while EITI was unfolding, so it's actually already on the portal. But that's a big deal. So while it's not meeting the standard of the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative in that it isn't reconciled, thanks, Paul, it's out there. So we're now able to see for the first time the Department of Interior showing all those revenues that they are collecting for the first time. So I'm really tremendously proud of where we've come. The biggest challenge we are facing is on tax reporting in the U.S. There are very few companies at this point that have agreed to report taxes, and that's a big challenge for us because that is one of the fundamental requirements for the international standard. And I'm very pleased, actually, that BHP has hosted this panel because in their report that they're releasing, they are releasing data on all of their tax payments. And they are also taking the step that industry in the U.S. has been hesitant to do so far, which is to embrace a certain level of project reporting, which I believe is at the EU compliant level. And that is a really important standard and example that the rest of the companies that are involved in this operation, I think, could learn a lot from your decision making and learn from your leadership. So I know there's a lot of people in the audience who know a lot more about this actually than I do. So I look forward to their questions as we move on.
All right.
Another thing, Danielle and I also were right and do scholarship together, so she, as usual, gets all my best lines. But I will say that our next speaker is Tony Cudmore. He joined BHP as the President of Corporate Affairs in March 2014. Prior to that, he was with ExxonMobil for 13 years, both in the United States and in Australia, occupying a wide range of senior and global corporate affairs roles. prior to that, was in government, including as the principal advisor to the then Premier of Victoria, the Honorable Jeff Kennett, Member of Parliament, and also worked in civil society. So, Tony, give us the corporate perspective.
Well, thank you, Norm. I will do that, but I will not give you any corporate spin. This is a spin-free zone, I can assure you today, from my perspective. But I did want to thank you for the opportunity, and Daniel, thanks for referencing some of the comments about our recent report. I thought I'd make a few opening remarks about our philosophy, if you like, of transparency, and then talk a little bit about some of the points of view that we're bringing, I think, to this debate as it continues to evolve, both here in the US and also around the world. I think the first point I'd make is that BHP Billiton, as many of you probably know, is the world's largest mining company and also a very significant oil and gas producer here in the United States, in the Gulf of Mexico, and also in the shale business. We're the largest foreign investor in the US shale sector, primarily in Texas, Arkansas, and Louisiana. But we are a global company. We have a commitment to operating long-term, expandable assets. So for us, that means really measuring our footprint in communities in decades, and potentially in some parts of the world in even longer time frames than that. And so for us, our commitment to being, if you like, a good corporate citizen and to being a responsible payer of taxes and royalties is very, very important. And we understand the responsibility that really does bestow on us. And that's a responsibility that's important because ultimately the revenue that we contribute does enable governments to provide the services and infrastructure that it's needed to improve their citizens' quality of life. And so for us, effective natural resource governance is both the right thing to do, but fundamentally it also creates the right business environment for us. And you know, the Deputy Secretary mentioned, I think he mentioned information as a strategic asset. Well, I think that's a really interesting way to look at it. And certainly from our point of view, the provision of information and greater transparency really does drive a more stable political environment and thus a more conducive investment environment. So it really is our view that countries that do transparently and effectively allocate natural resource wealth are most likely to create that be creating that stable political environment. And we've had this view for quite a long time. We're actually a founding member of the EITI. We have a member on the global board, and we think that is an important element of our overall approach to citizenship and business conduct. But we've gone a step further this year. We released last week a new report. We're calling it our Economic Contribution and Payments to Government Report. This is not spin, but here it is. You can get it on our website as well. But this is an important contribution to the debate because it's, for the first time, our company, and I believe certainly close to the first time in the sector and certainly for a major company, that we're reporting taxes and royalties on both a country-by-country and a project-by-project basis, and we're doing so in a manner that's consistent with the European Union Transparency Directive. And we have to comply with the European Union Transparency Directive when it comes in a year's time because part of our business is listed on the London Stock Exchange, so we're captured by EU regulation. We're equally listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and so we're certainly very much subject to jurisdiction here in the United States as well and in other countries. But we're undertaking this report, and we've published it a year early because we want to really try to achieve, hopefully, three contributions to the debate. The first is that we're in a period now of subdued global economic growth and commodity prices. And tax and, if you like, economic policy more generally are the subject of major discussion, as they should be, and we want to be able to contribute to that debate. Secondly, we want to be able to help all of our stakeholders understand our broader contribution beyond the taxes and royalties and other payments to government that we make, our broader contribution in terms of suppliers, salaries, and other aspects of our investment, if you like, in our supply chain. But thirdly, in our report, we're trying to make the case for the establishment of some sort of global equivalency here. So as the United States considers where it's going now, as the SEC considers its approach to transparency regulation here, It would certainly be our view that as we have the potential here for divergent approaches in many countries, that we make an effort to try to bring some degree of coherence and equivalency that will certainly make companies' lives less complex in terms of reporting, and we believe will help stakeholders compare and contrast data if it's done on a globally consistent basis. And the last point I would make is that transparency is very, very important. In our view, it is a means to an end, and the ultimate end is good governance of natural resources and the benefit that accrues to citizens of nations who produce those natural resources. So as the amount of data being disclosed increases around the world, and it is going to increase as various jurisdictions bring forward their own policies, and hopefully they can be brought to some degree of equivalence, we also think that it's very, very important that that data be easily understood and analysable by those that data seeks to benefit, being the citizens of the countries that are producing these natural resources. So for us, that's an important point. We've made it in the report, and we believe access to data, the level of data is important, as is the accessibility and the utility of that data. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Next, we'll hear from Robert Hunja. Robert is the Director for Public Integrity and Openness in the World Bank's Governance Global Practice. He will bridge on Tony's opening to the rest of the world by giving us some global reflections. He, in his current role, oversees the implementation of the World Bank's procurement policies, as well as a number of programs focused on enhancing transparency, citizen participation, and multi-stakeholder collaboration in countries across the globe. He previously managed the open government practice in the World Bank Institute, he is a Kenyan national and, like me, a lawyer by training. So he's been doing significant work in the field of openness and has worked in procurement, among other arenas, for over 17 years, including for the government of Kenya. Robert, how does the world look from your perspective on these issues? You can take an extra minute.
Thank you very much. I'll take the extra minute. How does the world look? The possibilities are immense, but the chances are bleak that things go wrong. Let me share why I say that. From where we sit as a World Bank, as an institution that cares very much about the trajectory of countries, I will mention two quandaries that we see that really are very important to this conversation. The first quandary is the capacity of natural resources to be transformational to development in countries. And that is well known. We've seen countries that have moved the development trajectory very well because they have managed their natural resources well. But that is coupled by also the reality of that if you look at Africa, for example, the continent from which I come from and which I care a lot about, there's a very close correlation between natural resources and conflict and war. It is so closely interrelated that you cannot avoid the fact that what is called the resource curse is not so much a resource curse, but a curse of poor governance. It's not the resources that actually make these countries go that trajectory of conflict and war. It's actually bad governance that leads them to that trajectory. So the question we are facing now as an institution is, as we look at the following two facts, how do we avoid these countries leading to the wrong trajectory? And these are the two facts that are emerging as we look at what's happening in the world right now. One is the places where new findings of oil, gas, minerals, and other natural resources are being found in large quantities. I would say 70% of them, the new countries, are in countries that have governance challenges. Again, if I give you an example of Africa, just on oil, it's Uganda, it's Kenya. If you look at gas, it's Mozambique. So places that have a history of serious governance deficits. And this is where the new findings are. And that's across the globe. I'm just giving you Africa as an example. The second fact is who is now coming into the business of getting these resources out of the ground or wherever it is they are. Many of them are companies from emerging markets where corporate governance is not exemplary, so they're not BHP Billiton. So if you combine these two facts, that the findings are in countries where governance challenges are significant, the companies that are going to be involved in bringing these resources into the market come from places where corporate governance is a challenge. It gives you the immensity of the challenge, the potential sorry trajectories again. So what do we do in this when we are faced with this quandary, where the potential of natural resources to enrich people's lives and for people to have greater meaning is very huge, but the chances of things going wrong is very large? So I think that's part of the challenge we face globally, and not just us as the World Bank, but as people who really care about people, because ultimately it is about people. So let me finish with a little bit of a commercial about what it is we're doing as an institution. We're doing a couple of things. One is focusing very hard and working very closely with those governments that are coming online as new countries in this arena, trying to see and undergird them so that they avoid the wrong trajectory. They avoid becoming the DRCs and the North Nigerias and the other places. So helping them with legal frameworks that promote greater transparency, helping them with policy formulation that helps them think through really on a long-term basis how they can use these resources to develop better. Helping them think through how they can create greater trust between governments and their citizens, because ultimately conflict comes about when citizens don't trust that their resources are being used to make their lives better. And here the transparency and accountability work is really, really important. And then we're doing a couple of things. One is supporting very much EITI. We have a pot of money that we have put together to support countries implement their EITI commitments. And that is very, very interesting work that is bearing good fruit, also with lots of learnings. And one of the learnings, as I move to conclude, is that transparency is important in itself, and it's really a sine qua non for really being able to involve citizens in engaging their governments to avoid the wrong trajectory. But making transparency have meaning, so that the data that is put out there is being used for whatever purposes, making transparency have meaning is a non-trivial exercise. It's something we have to work on together for a very long time, building the capacity of various stakeholders to have the capacity to engage with the data and the information that is being put out there through all these transparency mechanisms. So this is something we're very committed to do, but obviously we can only succeed if we work in concert with others. Finally, let me just conclude by saying this. So the challenge is significant. The opportunities are very exciting, which is to get countries to move on positive trajectories. But we have to, even on the transparency agenda, and transparency doesn't solve anything, but even on the transparency agenda, we have to work on a couple of things that are really important. We have, especially in this industry, in this arena, dark pockets of opaqueness that we have actually accepted that they should continue to exist. Let me just give you an example as I conclude. Contracts. Concession contracts and contracts around oil, gas, and mining are largely still held in secret. Yeah? And if you think about it, this is totally unacceptable because these are public contracts about public goods. So we have to work hard again, not just pushing the transparency agenda and making transparency have meaning, working with countries so that they avoid the wrong trajectories, but also focusing on those areas of darkness and opaqueness that still exist in this industry. So that's why we're excited to join up with colleagues such as this at this panel and together to work hard and in concert to help countries improve. And finally, so that the people, because we cannot forget that it's finally about the people, that the people's lives are improved. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. And we thank the World Bank for all you do everywhere on the planet. Our final speaker, cleanup hitter, is my friend Nathaniel Heller, a managing director at R4D, the Results for Development Institute, which he joined in 2014, where he leads R4D's governance program. Prior to joining R4D, he was the co-founder and the executive director of Global Integrity, an NGO that promotes government transparency and accountability worldwide. And before that, served at the United States Department of State, focusing on European Palmel affairs, as we in the diplomatic family call it, political military affairs, and also worked for, among others, the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Nathaniel, what can we do to pick up on Robert's question? What works and what doesn't to make transparency have meaning globally?
Well, my guidance before this was to try and weave some sort of common thread and summarize a bit or draw out an insight or two. So I'll answer that in trying to tie this together. I actually want to repeat one of the last things Robert mentioned, because to me it actually is a very interesting arc in this conversation that I think is worth surfacing. I mean, this may not be verbatim, but it was transparency itself is important, but making it have meaning is a non-trivial exercise, which I fully endorse. So what I found really interesting, I don't think there was any coaching or prompting, was we started with the Deputy Secretary talking about what I would describe as the intrinsic value of transparency. So we heard, you know, transparency, accountability, public trust, and Danielle in many ways reemphasized a lot of that. We need to know who's working for who, where the dollars are, where the data is, the revolving door issues, essentially, you know, in some ways arguing that there is a thickening of social fabric, a deepening of the democratic contract, not to get too verbose, that results when we embrace and invest in these sorts of transparency measures. And I felt Tony helps highlight the alternative or parallel paradigm, which is the instrumental value of transparency. We start to hear about the benefits for citizens, for local communities, and Robert very much and very helpfully really driving at this, unsurprisingly, from the bank's perspective, that, you know, for you all, fundamentally, you have to be able to argue for the return on investment at the community, almost the individual level. Is this transparency work improving the availability of clinics, whether teachers show up to school? I mean, conflict being the most acute case. And to me, that's been one of the fascinating tensions, and I don't think it's a zero-sum tension, but it's a fascinating tension that has cropped up time and again and sort of persists, particularly within the extractives universe. This is really interesting, I think, within the context of EITI and in developing countries, and I'm no expert, there are many others both on this dais and in the audience who are, but what we've seen is this a sort of theology that's been advanced, which argues that greater transparency helps, I mean, I'm going to paraphrase and be intentionally glib, but greater transparency equals less diversion of funds. That's a good thing. Less diversion of funds leads, hopefully, to smarter and or more spending on social safety net programs, on development programs, and that kind of spending ideally improves people's lives. And again, this is a broad brush caricature. And I subscribe to that, and I aspire to it. But there's a huge amount of complexity. Tony touched on it, Robert, most of the others did as well. I'm a big believer in the idea that greater transparency will actually, in the short term and medium term, lead to less stealing of resources, and you have more dollars in the coffers, particularly public sector coffers. That's a good thing. But do we really get smarter policy decisions and or smarter and better and greater spending on the alternative choices? So if all of a sudden we have $100 million we didn't have, are we going to get more spending on health or education, or do you go and buy a bunch of frigates, or do you buy a bunch of bullets, or et cetera? And money is fungible, of course, right, particularly within public sector budgeting. So there's a lot of complexity there. There's a lot of assumptions that we all make around essentially evidence-informed policymaking. So now we've got more money. Of course, we will logically spend it on the things we should spend it on that affect people's lives. Maybe instead we bid on the Olympics and lose, $15 billion hosting the Olympics, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of problematizing that's worth sort of thinking through when we're engaging with government interlocutors, particularly in low-income and aid-dependent contexts, when we're sort of trotting out these arguments to just be sure that we're not sort of setting a set of false expectations. There's also a huge amount of disagreement that remains within the extractives universe around what the best practice model is for spending that money better. Do you sort of go the Norway model and have a sort of protected trust fund that's set up through from which one can draw in a very transparent way to spend on particular programs? There's a whole community that argues for just putting this with the Treasury. Don't worry, the trust fund's a bad idea, waste of money and time and resources. Just stick it in the Treasury and let the Treasury do it. And I don't think we really know what the best model is, and it's very context dependent. So to me, a lot of this does come down to trying to intentionally problematize the automaticity that we invoke almost subconsciously between greater objectives, transparency, and improved outcomes that affect people's lives. I think it does happen. We have a lot of stories where it does happen, particularly at the local level. But from a systems change level, can we really guarantee this in all cases? I don't think we can. To me, that is part of the vanguard of where we're going. There's a lot of interesting research now that's starting to be launched. I mean, Robert's been trying to push this. Certainly we have at R4D. Even Norm, I know, is trying to work on this in trying to better draw out these links. I mean, it's really hard research and evidence building work, but we have a lot of new techniques we didn't have 15, 20 years ago. And I have some high hopes for this work. So, you know, to offer just some food for thought for the forthcoming discussion, I would sort of, you know, think about that theory of change that a lot of us both consciously and subconsciously invoke around these issues, and try and intentionally make it harder. And I think that actually reveals a lot of points of intervention.
Thank you, Nathaniel. I want to thank the panel. And before we turn it over to all of you for your questions, so get your questions ready, please. I'll invoke my moderator's privilege to just piggyback on that, that what we're seeing is we've heard in the United States from the government perspective, from perspective of other stakeholders globally, from a business, an NGO, and the World Bank perspective, what we're seeing is a convergence of understanding on principles. But with the principles comes a multiplicity of practices. And the trick is getting to a consensus on best practices and finding the data and the evidence about what works and what doesn't. So in that sense, we're all flying the plane as we build the engine and try to figure out where the evidence leads us. I want to thank the panelists because you've really given us a tour around the globe of how every different type of stakeholder is addressing these issues, and we have really an extraordinarily rich body of expertise represented today by all of you. We're all so impressed in looking at the broad range of experts represented on the RSVP list today. So with that, while I do have some more questions for my colleagues, I think that I will open the floor to our guests. There are two of my friends who have microphones, and we will we'll start here with this gentleman in the second row. And just tell us who you are when you ask your question, please.
Yeah, my name is Tony Carroll. I'm a vice president of Manchester Trade, and I teach as an adjunct professor across the street at Johns Hopkins. I'd like to ask Robert a question, maybe drawing upon his experience as a lawyer in Kenya. About 10 years ago, John Gatongo came here and actually spoke about his book, My Turn to Eat, I believe it is, about changing political structures doesn't necessarily lead to improvement, that there's an ingrained element in governance in Kenya that has fostered years and years and years of corruption. 10 years since then, Kenya's made some accomplishments in broadening its tax base. Actually, Kenya now, among all African countries, draws more upon its domestic tax revenues than any other. My question is, the begetting of corruption through the type of resource flows that come from extractive resources into government allows for a sort of rent-seeking behavior by leaders. Do you think the idea of broadening the tax base will increase social contracts and allow for more, shall we say, critical review by citizenry of how government is run? And I'd like to perhaps point this in your reference to Kenya now, about to become itself a natural resource producer of some magnitude.
You may answer, please. I'd like to know also.
Well, I'd like to know too, but I don't know how much time we have, but so I'll be very brief. I think the premise of your question is entirely right. So just to share with you, in 2006, I actually left the bank and went back home, joined government, joined the Ministry of Finance as a director of public procurement, which is a very interesting patch from which to watch the governance question. And as Kenyans, we are actually quite worried about this question because as taxpayers, if we see that our taxes are being collected well, which there is evidence now, and they're being used well, our trust in the governance system increases. Now, if more and more resources are coming not from the pockets of taxpayers, but from natural resources, we begin to worry that that link will begin to weaken. And it's a significant problem. And I'm using Kenya as just an example. It's the same in many of those countries around there, that this risk is very, very huge. And that's why I'm saying the opportunity actually to move the trajectory up is significant, but the risk premium is also very high. And we, as Kenyans, but also all our other partners, need to focus very hard on ensuring that that we don't fall into the wrong trajectory. But the risk is not it's not zero. It's not minimal. It's significant.
If I can just do a follow-on to Mike and to Danielle, your question about the relationship between changing structures and achieving improved outcomes goes to something that I kibitzed on when I was in the White House, but that Interior and POGO and others in the NGO sector were very busy on, which was the restructuring of MMS. Mr. Deputy Secretary, do you think the breakup of MMS into three discrete entities, the structural reform, has been a success in improving governance? And Danielle, I'd be curious on your whether you think it succeeded as well. Perhaps it offers some lessons both in how bad it was at MMS, what was going on there with sex and drugs. They left out the rock and roll, but they had plenty of sex and drugs. What was going on there, I think, would represent a low anywhere on the planet. And the structural reforms, I think, have been very interesting. So what are your views, if I may ask you briefly?
Well, because of those issues that existed at MMS, I think the restructuring of MMS and divvying it up into three different organizations is a success right off the bat, because I think it did indicate a recognition of the problems inherent in that organization and the need to address them through organizational changes. So I think it had some value from that standpoint. But beyond that, I think as we've seen the process play out, it's been very successful in allowing folks to focus on certain activities, the leasing, the allocation, the analysis that goes on with respect to making resources available, particularly here in the offshore coast, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, then the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement has been able to regulate and focus on safety standards, both offshore in the Gulf of Mexico and in the Arctic, as we've had some Arctic activity this past summer. And then HONOR, the Office of Natural Resources Revenue, has been able to really focus its energies on valuation issues. And so we've got people able to exert organizational priorities to areas that we've needed to. If you had one organization, I think you do have the issues of complexity of people working with industry in different roles and how does that compete with each other. But I think we just have been able to have more priorities move forward based on the independence of those organizations to focus on their own expertise.
Danielle, has the breakup restored HONOR?
Honor to honor. Well, first, I think it's important to recognize that the breakup happened because of the extraordinary sort of salaciousness of the problems that were really revealed by the IG. But there had been problems that POGO had been working on for more than a decade prior to that in the fact that that office had, over time, we believed, had become so intertwined with the industry that it was regulating that it had lost sight of what the companies really owed, and were allowing the companies to promote and implement policies or push for the implementation of policies that were allowing a dramatic underpayment of what they owed. So that's sort of actually the kind of thing that worries us across the government is how industry can influence policymaking legally, essentially. And so once the sort of extraordinary, the drama of MMS became more apparent, and to be clear for those of you who aren't as familiar with what that meant, MMS had been charged, Minerals Management Service had been charged with the basically conflicting mission of both promoting the leasing of and production of extractives on public land, and at the same time auditing and collecting the information they owe that were owed to the government. And so what happened was it was actually divided into three different sections, one focused entirely on safety, one on the collection and auditing, and then the other on leasing. And I think certainly on its face, that's an incredibly important thing that happened. At that time also, there was the ending of what we thought was a very failed exercise in allowing the companies to pay royalties in kind rather than paying in dollars, which was also sort of indicative of the kinds of problems that MMS was allowing to happen. So so we're feeling that that was clearly a step forward, and this is one of these things where we don't think there's any more sex and drugs and rock and roll happening, but... so, you know, this, I think things are okay until we find out that they're not.
All right. Let's hear from someone on this side of the room. Yes, sir. Again, tell us who you are.
Yeah,
brief questions.
Yeah, sure. Jim Snyder, Isolan. I would estimate that the U.S. public airwaves are worth about $1 trillion. Are they, according to your definition of natural resources, a natural resource? And if they are a natural resource, should we be concerned about having the same type of transparency in corruption regulations we have for the tangible natural resources for this other realm? I would argue that the transparency and accountability mechanisms for the public airwaves in the United States are far, far worse than for our tangible natural resource, where at least the public has some intuitive sense of, you know, things that are physical as opposed to invisible. But should it be part of this discussion or not? It's arguably one of the most, if not the most important, natural resource in the United States. Of course, it's a new resource. It wasn't very valuable 20 years ago, but now it's incredibly valuable.
Okay, Nathaniel, do you want to express an opinion on that?
No, I think it's a brilliant question. I appreciate you raising that. I don't know if I have an answer. I mean, the cliche that's been trotted out by a lot of folks, including myself, in the last several years is this idea of data as the new natural resource. And I think it's a parallel question to yours. I mean, yeah, in the domestic context a little bit, I know absolutely. I mean, we have a kind of messed up process for how we deal with spectrum licensing and how we deal with buybacks, et cetera, et cetera. So absolutely, more transparency there is a great thing. But I think globally, if you think about the problems we have in a fairly well, I mean, all things considered, well-developed regulatory framework and environment in the United States, can you imagine in some of the emerging economies and lower income contexts, when you're dealing with broadband rollout now, when you're dealing with a deregulated media landscape, I mean, it is the Wild West. I mean, a lot of us know this sort of firsthand. It's a real nightmare. You look at media ownership and control and concentration. You know, governors and political leadership running stuff. If you look in Eastern Europe right now, and you have powerful mafia figures running the majority of the media landscape, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of horror show out there around these issues. I don't mean that quite seriously. Sort of looking at Robert, this is really tough stuff. The only good news is these processes are so fresh and sort of fluid right now in a number of economies and countries. There's a chance to maybe get it right. I think in the U.S., it's arguably more of an uphill battle. I mean, there's clearly some advocacy and good work that's been done, more to be done, but it's a grind. And I think there's an interesting moment in a number of middle-income, transitional, and even some lower and middle-income countries to make a big bang sort of shift so that they're not having 25 years from now to sort of fight the slog that we're fighting domestically.
I would just add to that, Jim, that because in the U.S. we are incorporating renewables as one of the extractives, you know, we're sort of setting the stage for it not just being those natural resources that are not renewable. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to.
Fascinating. Okay, we have time, I think, for one last question, maybe for two if we're very efficient. Shauna, you can, as somebody pass the microphone to that young lady over there.
Hi, my name is Karen St. John, and I used to work for the petroleum industry. I've recently retired. Was involved with the EITI in various countries early on, but it's been a number of years. I was wondering, where are all of these transparency initiatives now vis-a-vis state-owned enterprises, which we know in many countries that's where the big stuff is?
Okay. Tony, you have a global perspective. Do you want to reflect on that?
Well, Norman, I think what I would say is that's obviously been quite a significant debate, particularly in the United States, particularly around some of the APIs, earlier concerns with the potential SEC rule. I suppose we've taken a slightly different point of view, so I'm not going to speak for any other company other than to say we've taken, a slightly more unilateral view we're not really we're making decisions in our own right and making decisions based on what we think is the right thing to do in the jurisdictions in which we operate, which is all we can ultimately do. Beyond that, though, we clearly want to provide our voice more broadly, which is that more transparency, notwithstanding some of the caveats Nathaniel and Robert you mentioned around, well, what's the ultimate impact, which is an important debate, but generically speaking, the more transparency, the more informed the debate's going to be. So I don't really want to comment on the SOE sector per se, because it's not really inherently relevant to our business, other than to say, it's obviously a debate that's alive and well still here.
Anybody else want to add to the SOE question? Mike?
Well, that's another question that I think is a very good one. You can go down all kinds of paths. I go back to the discussion I had with my counterpart in Mexico earlier this spring, and we talked mostly about the context of EITI in the mining industry, because Pemex is a state-owned entity. But there are obviously lots of questions pursuant to this discussion that, what are they expending for operations? What are the profits that could be reinvested in other governmental function? That kind of transparency, which I think is relevant and important. And I'm not quite sure how they're going to. I'm not quite sure how they deal with it now, and how they're going to deal that with the context of EITI. Same thing with. We don't have state-owned entities here, but I used to run an organization, the Bureau of Reclamation, which is a water resources development agency, which has a lot of information about the availability of water resources. And I think the same principles apply: the demand for transparency, for understanding how we made decisions, was just an imperative to navigate through the issues in that context. So I think it has relevance in private extractive industries for a lot of the reasons discussed, but the need for transparency with the public and just managing the resource and understanding decision-making, I think, transcends beyond EITI.
I'm looking at our timekeepers who are sick. Can we do one more question? Okay. We'll do the last question. Stand up. Pass this young lady a microphone.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Shanna Devine. I'm with the Government Accountability Project. We're a whistleblower support organization here in Washington, D.C. And I'm wondering, as you discuss public trust, accountability, and the role of data, what role would you feel whistleblowers play in holding both corporations and governments accountable? Certainly, this is something that Danielle could speak to. I'd also like to know specifically what concrete measures both the Department of Interior as well as the World Bank are taking to support whistleblowing within the fight of within the effort to fight corruption. Thank you very much.
I think the MMS investigation was initiated by a whistleblower who reached out to IG Devaney. I'll just ask anybody who wants to comment quickly. Maybe we can just go down the row, actually, to let everybody close out on the answer to Ms. Devine's question.
I think at the Department of the Interior, we have to continue. Obviously, it was a large focus for this administration when we came in and assumed responsibility for managing the department. We had the issues with MMS that had already surfaced. So there are lots of processes for whistleblowers, but from the top levels of leadership, reiterating the expectation of how we do business and the willingness and how much we want people to step forward is an incredible message from leadership's perspective that we constantly need to reiterate.
thank you for that softball to Shanna. Certainly, Norm and I spent many hours working with Shanna, as well as many others, on getting the legislation passed. It has been passed so far. There certainly is a lot more that needs to be done, especially for holding accountable those who retaliate against whistleblowers, where there's still great lacking in all the sectors. So there's still a lot more work for us to do, because it's true that all the great reforms really generally do start with a whistleblower letting us know what's happening.
I would just say, from our company's perspective, whistleblower protection is absolutely critical. It's critical to the values that we have, and we operate in many jurisdictions. Each of those jurisdictions has whistleblower protections in some capacity. If you're interested, in fact, we just made a submission to a Senate inquiry in Australia just this week on questions of anti-corruption compliance. And there's a section on whistleblowing in there that's the latest and most up-to-date. But we stand behind very much the importance of robust policies and procedures in that regard.
Yeah, of course, hugely important. I would just add, I think, you know, the whistleblowing issue is one that paints a really complex picture of the legacy of this administration domestically on these issues. And, without intentionally being too impolite, I mean, the sort of fetish and witch hunt habit that this administration has pursued is none of us have a good answer for or an explanation for why, despite the legislation, despite huge investments of political capital and other capital and a variety of open government and transparency initiatives, the whistleblowers thing is like treated on this island and in this very hot pocket of vitriol is sort of spewed out on a regular basis. So I think this is going to be one in the coming decade, as we look back on the administration, we may have a more cogent story to explain it, but I really don't. I feel this could be an important priority for the last, you know, whatever it is, 18, 20 months of the administration to make this whole again. And I feel like that's a big agenda.
Well, thank you. I think so. One of the things that we have done institutionally is support, both technically but also with resources, the adoption of whistleblower legislation in many, many countries. A big question as to what impact this is really having in the countries in which we operate, because a lot of it is not so much about the legislation and all this, it's about trust, and whether communities really trust that if people come out, they will be protected, so that they won't be retaliated against. So it's a big question out there as to whether this really has meaning in many of these places.
Well, I'll only add my strong belief in the importance of protecting whistleblowers. It was a privilege for me when I was in the administration to work on that, to get the WPA, the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, passed. It took us much longer than we thought. And one of the lessons we learned at the beginning, this is another panel to reflect on, but to answer Nathaniel's question, one of the lessons that we learned was that not was that the political leadership of administration comes and goes, but there are deep, deep institutional prerogatives. And I think the beginning of an answer to your question, Nathaniel, would be to look at the institutional prerogatives, the permanent long-standing bureaucracies. That's accounted for some of the phenomenon you describe. And it's come at a time of great stress because of the new nature of instantaneous global electronic communication and the ability now to put large bodies of information out in public in a way that was not possible before, and how people, some of whom with good faith and perhaps some with not equally good faith, have reacted to that environment. And political leaderships of administrations are often only able to turn that battleship incrementally. But it's a serious question that requires more reflection. I want to thank the panel. Really, we've packed an extraordinarily rich conversation, and all of you for your outstanding questions. We've traveled the United States and the globe, and its many sectors and stakeholders, as we've tackled these important policy questions in the specific context resource development and management, and how we can turn the resource curse, perhaps someday, with all of your leadership, all of your help, into a resource blessing. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today.